This week's guest leads one of the largest social service agencies in New Hampshire. Today, we talk to him about what the major issues facing our state are and the role his organization is playing to address them. I'm Matt Mowry, co-publisher and executive editor of Business New Hampshire Magazine and Granite Media Group.
And I'm Christine Kerrigan, co-publisher of Business NH Magazine and chief creative officer for Granite Media Group. And welcome to BizCast NH.
So, with our guest today, it had me thinking about how to businesses give back, because mm-hmm. you know, it's important to be a good corporate citizen. And even though B&H has been around quite a while, we
40 years this year.
Isn't that, it just blows my mind. But you know, we've owned the company for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So we're still in sort of startup phase,
right,
as it were. So we're just kind of getting to the stage where we're thinking about, okay, now that we have our feet under us, how do we start to give back to the greater community?
Mm-hmm. And I know for me, one of my goals when we bought the company was I do want to be an organization that's able to give back. To me, that's something that's very important. So I think, you know, in our situation right now, as you said, financially, it may not necessarily be possible right now, being kind of a year and a half into our 40-year startup.
Yes.
40-year-old company, but startup for us since we are new owners, like you mentioned. So I think it's finding creative ways to do that give back with the resources that you have. So with us, for, you know, we have the magazine, the print magazine. So it could look like a trade with a service organization. So, you know, maybe we can offer them some advertising space in order to promote their message, which would be a way that we can give back, you know, if it's not necessarily financially at this point.
Right. And, you know, we run the Best Companies to Work For, the Business of the Year competition. Both those competitions have a social justice element to them, where we ask businesses about how they're good corporate citizens and give back. And there is such a wide variety of ways. I think checkbook charity gets a bad rap because, you know, it nonprofits need fuel, and mm-hmm. that fuel is money. They yeah. need money and volunteers in order to meet their mission. And I think sometimes, you know, some folks get wrapped up in, I want all my money to go to direct services. I don't want them going to overhead. I want to have impact. And I've never understood that, because I'm like, why would you handcuff your donation that way? Because those nonprofits cannot meet their mission if they don't have great employees, if they aren't able to keep the lights on and pay rent and all these other things. I would rather they're just, even in my personal donations, give and not have any strings attached to it. Like, if I'm giving to you, I'm trusting, because I like your mission and I like your organization, so I'm going to trust that you're going to spend the money where you need to do it.
Right. It's those unrestricted funds.
Yes.
Because if people are able to choose where they want the money to go, great. You could have an overabundance of money that is going to one particular area, but if there's no unrestricted funds, or there's no funds that have been given to staffing or to other such kind of operational needs, I feel like it probably puts those organizations in kind of a bind.
Right.
Because you have this bank of money here, but you can't use it for what you kind of need it to, because it's designated for a specific area, but you need to pay your staff.
And especially in this post-pandemic era we find ourselves in, the social needs of our communities have changed so dramatically, and the social issues and challenges that we face as communities and as a state and as a nation have become so much more pronounced and challenging that nonprofits are really having to pivot and finding new ways to deliver services or deliver new services. And you need the funding to be able to do that. But I mean, even if you're a small business like ourselves and you go, right now, you know, we don't have a lot of extra, there are so many ways to get, you know, we have continued our volunteer status so that we have time off for our employees that mm-hmm. just designated for volunteering. They don't have to dip into vacation time. And we've also got a flexible schedule. So they may even be able to go and volunteer for something, and then they they choose to do their work around that. So they're not even having to dip into that. And I think that's so important to encourage volunteering in your organization, because again, that is a lifeline for nonprofits, is that volunteer efforts that are put forward.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we could continue to talk about this, but it's a perfect way to lead right into our guest today, because I'm sure he'll have a lot to tell us about the service organization, service industry. Today's guest is Tom Blonsky, who has served as the President and Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Charities New Hampshire since March 2006. Tom leads the mission of Catholic Charities to meet the increasing needs of the poor and vulnerable of New Hampshire through expanded social services. Serving more than 125,000 people throughout New Hampshire each year, Catholic Charities NH offers programs and services that include mental health counseling, community service case management, immigration legal services, the New Hampshire Food Bank, St. Charles School, the Caregivers and Monadnock at Home for Elderly Services, Liberty House for Veteran Services, Our Place, a parenting and pregnancy education service, New Generation, a shelter for single mothers and children, and nursing and rehabilitation facilities. Beyond his role at Catholic Charities NH, Tom serves on the New Hampshire Supreme Court's Character and Fitness Committee and Board of Directors for the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits. He is also a member of the Executive Committee for Diocesan Directors for Catholic Charities USA and serves on the public policy committees of the Diocese of Manchester and the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. A graduate of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, Tom also holds an MBA with a specialization in healthcare from the University of Connecticut. He is a graduate of Leadership New Hampshire, Leadership Greater Manchester, Leadership Seacoast, Leadership Nashua, and an active member of the Manchester Rotary. Tom lives in Brentwood with his wife and three children and is an avid runner. Tom is a certified youth minister and is an active volunteer in his church community. In conjunction with Seacoast Family Promise, he is also the coordinator of the Homeless Ministry Program at St. Mary's Church in Newmarket. Welcome, Tom. That's quite a resume. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And that's our time today. Yeah. Just an impressive resume, not only of yourself, but of the organization. And I've been familiar and covering Catholic Charities New Hampshire over many times over the 24 years I've been with BNH. And yet every time I'm always amazed by the breadth of services the organization provides. What is it like? I think for any of our executives out there, it's got to be top of mind. How do you manage an organization that big?
Well, first off, let me congratulate you on your 40th anniversary.
Thank you.
The New Hampshire Food Bank, which is one of our most recognized programs, is also celebrating their 40th year today. So grateful for that.
Oh, excellent.
So, thank you. So I think you manage it by having exceptional staff who work with you, who work along with you, and really making it about a we issue where everyone has buy-in and everyone embraces the mission and understands the impact and the outcomes we're trying to drive. So we have exceptional staff who are really, really tremendously committed, and I'm very grateful for that.
And what is the number of staff that you have at Catholic Charities?
Well, fully staffed. I don't know who's fully staffed nowadays.
Right,
would be,
right.
You know, 1,000 to 1,200.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's quite an organization. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you into this organization?
So celebrated my 18th anniversary a couple weeks ago. And I remember back in, 2004, 2005, I was running nursing facilities in Connecticut. The kids were very young at the time, and that was the time to make a move. As you know, when kids are younger and they're not entrenched with their friends, groups in middle school and elementary school and all that. So I applied for this job as a long shot back when there was newspaper advertising. It was through the Boston Globe. And I hadn't had experience in any kind of fundraising or social services. I did in the healthcare arena with running nursing facilities. So I applied for it as a long shot just for a change and to broaden my horizons in terms of just exposure to different arenas. And here I am 18 years later.
And so I'd like to dive into some of the different areas of services that you provide. Just give folks a better idea of just the depth of services that there are in this organization. So let's talk about one probably the best known, and that's the New Hampshire Food Bank. Can you talk about what a food bank is and the role it plays? We'll start there.
So a food bank is it's a distribution center. So it's a warehouse, and you typically there's one, maybe two or three, depending on how large the state is. New Hampshire only has one, although there's some confusions where people might interchange the words and call a pantry a food bank. Mm-hmm. So the New Hampshire Food Bank supports about 425 different food pantries, after school programs, senior programs, the Boys and Girls Clubs. Some of them, they provide pre-made meals for them for their after school programs. And we have training programs in our kitchen so that people can graduate with manager's level ServSafe certification and can get a job in the hospitality arena or in the dietary departments at hospitals or nursing facilities, different things like that. We have a robust SNAP program to get people enrolled with for SNAP benefits so that they can use those to buy food, nutritious food for their families. We have mobile food pantries around the state, so we bring the food to communities rather than them having to come to us. So it's multi-pronged at trying to attack hunger on many different levels. We also are looking, Eileen, our executive director, has done a phenomenal job in really focusing on nutrition. You know, so that we're not just pushing garbage food where mm-hmm. that might be donated that isn't selling at the retail level or maybe from the national level, from a national provider. So we're not pushing out potato chips and high sugar foods. It's really pushing nutritional valued foods that are going to really have sustaining power with the end user. So great program.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned food that gets donated to the food bank. Is it all donation-based, the food that comes into the food bank, or how do you get that product into the food bank to distribute?
It used to be more that it was donated from national producers and locally from our supermarkets and things like that. Now that their inventory management has improved. So there's the just-in-time, you know, inventory management. So they're not over forecasting. So it's very, very efficient. And anything that is dented or close to the sell-by date, they're discounting. So their margins are really small. So we don't get the same types of donations that we used to. We still get some reclaimed meat that is past the sell-by date that we can, or protein, they call it, that we can use that for our cooking program. It's still good as long as you either freeze it or cook it right away for the protein component of the Recipe for Success program. But we are purchasing 25, depending on the month, 25 to 35% of our food. Mm-hmm. So that requires donations, right, which we're grateful for. And people have been very generous to the food bank.
In our April issue, it's our food issue, and we explored the intersection of food and the economy. And one of the stories we're doing, obviously, centers around food insecurity, and Food Bank was a great resource for us there. Can you talk about the mounting need we are seeing and the increasing food insecurity that, despite being one of the wealthiest states in the nation, that we're experiencing here in the Granite State?
So I will talk about that through the lens of maybe our district offices, because mm-hmm. that we have seven or eight throughout the state. And the people we're seeing coming into our district offices that are looking for help, whether it be food assistance or gas card assistance or heat assistance or electricity assistance or a car payment or a car repair or rent or something like that, we've had a 30.3% increase in the last year alone in terms of who is showing up at our doors. And it's not the person who is sleeping on a park bench necessarily. It is someone who might be working as an individual or a couple where both of them are working. And because of increases in utility costs or rents, we know how astronomical rents are. Or even the cost of food, or look what inflation has looked like in the last couple of years. So it may be one incident, like I said, a car repair, or maybe it's a chronic illness and where they have a medical debt that just, you know, brings them back underwater. So they're coming to us and looking for assistance with food support, and maybe we direct them to the food bank or to a food pantry, or we give them a food voucher or something like that, or a gift card. Or it might be, like I said, electricity, it might be rent, it might be a car repair, it might be heating. A lot of it is geared toward prevention. You know, so we work in conjunction with homeless programs, but a lot of our programs are preventing homelessness because it's like whack-a-mole. They're ahead 1 month and then they're knocked down again the next month with another bill that they didn't anticipate because they're living paycheck to paycheck.
Can you talk about some of those other programs that you work, that you have to help combat homelessness?
Yep.
So kind of what's involved with those?
Sure. So we have two transitional living programs. We have Liberty House in Manchester that works with veterans. And that program takes in vets who are struggling with maybe some PTS issues, that are struggling with maybe some SUD issues, some of them formerly incarcerated, some of them who have been other than honorably discharged and really are just trying to get their life back together because they've made a couple of mistakes. So we want to honor those who have fought for us and sacrificed their lives for our freedom and give back to them and support them to get them back to wholeness. So they'll come in. We house them. There is no fee for the housing while they start with us and engage them in intense case management. They work with a LADAC, so a licensed drug and addiction counselor. And really with all of our programs, we have a life plan that we overlay into that is a critical component of our programs where the life plan will be an initial assessment and it explores all the social determinants of health and the red light areas in their lives that are preventing them from leading a life of wholeness. So it might be, depending on the program, whether it's the Liberty House program, the veterans program, it might be counseling that they need, job as a or education as a pathway out of poverty. Looking at all these various pathways out of poverty, is it stable housing? Is it transportation? Is it access to healthcare? All these potential red light areas, and then figuring out via micro goals, meeting them where they are, and figuring out where is the best place to start. Because it's like for some of them, it's like drinking from a fire hose. I can't possibly. I have red light areas all over the map. Where do I even start? Well, let's, you know, look at maybe education as a start, as a pathway out of poverty, like I said, or a job. But some of these guys are coming in and they just need to get their life in order by starting with, how do I get my Social Security card? You know, how do I get my license? How do I just get my life in order so I have a starting point so I can then maybe enroll in a trade or then start to look for a job and then get the counseling support and then the addiction support and all that. And then really rebuilding the relationships that have fractured, you know, that have become fractured along the way with their family or maybe with their children if they have estranged children. So things like that. And our program New Generation in Greenland, which is for moms and children, some of them who have been formerly incarcerated or dealing with SUD issues similarly, will come to our program. They live in community. They will meet at least once a week, if not more often, to engage in support groups. The great outcome for that program is 88% of women who graduate from that program and receive aftercare services. So aftercare services are if we will sit for their children while they're working, holding a job, and just coming in for support services when they're in the community. 88% of them are still remaining in their homes a year after they're out of our program. So that is breaking the cycle of poverty. That's what we're all about, is moving lives forward and breaking the cycle of poverty.
That's excellent.
So I want to go to your origin story, as it were, you know, and talk about nursing homes for a bit. This one of the services that you provide, and that was your background originally. Talk about how important it is to have services in place to help those for the elderly in a state which is one of the oldest states in the nation. And, you know, we have a huge population, the boomers, that are really moving into that phase of life where they're having to plan for the future. And what will aging into the latter part stages of their life look like? So one, can you talk about what attracted you to nursing home as a field? And then two, what is the role that Catholic Charities New Hampshire is playing in that field here in New Hampshire?
So what attracted me to the role initially was I had a very strong influence from both of my grandparents growing up. We would spend many weekends with my Irish grandparents and the Polish side, you know, from different perspectives. But a lot of, I think, my formation as a child growing up and even as a young adult was because of their influence. So I just want to ensure that there is equal access to services and that we see the value in aging, in a sense that we don't treat people as if they're, you know, past their sell by date or past their use by date or whatever, which is traditionally what we do in our society, where there is a lot of ageism still at place, and we sort of dismiss the seniors as, you know, as irrelevant in a sense. And I want to honor them for what they, you know, they were the ones who raised us, and it's our turn to give back to them and provide the best possible services and access to the best possible services that they can. So with our nursing facilities, next year will be our 80th anniversary. So grateful for that. We've been doing housing for 80 years, whether it started as orphanages at St. Charles and in Rochester, which is now a school, with our nursing facilities. I think back then they were called sanitariums or something like that. So we do affordable senior independent living. We do assisted living. We do dementia care, long-term care, subacute care, and we do middle income senior living. So there is a need for all of those services. And I'm glad you brought up senior care and, you know, what our thoughts are for senior care moving forward, because in a couple of years, I think before 2030, New Hampshire will be classified as a super aged state, where 20% of those 65 or older will be classified, you know, will that our population will be encompassed of, you know, 20% or greater of those 65 or older. And I think we're not going to be the only one in that category. I think there's a number of states joining arms with us. But what are we doing about that? And what are we doing to serve them and provide services and access to services? It's certainly, the answer isn't institutional care, obviously. That should be one component or one solution. But what are we doing to help them age in place? How are we integrating technology? How are we training our workforce to engage with seniors either in the setting where they want to age? If we can do that, the challenge is our rural healthcare. How do we administer healthcare or home care in a rural setting? It's just not efficient when people want to age in place. So there's some challenges we have ahead of us, but the state is very much on top of it. I'm on the steering committee with AHA, the Alliance for Healthy Aging, and there's a system of care that's in place that a state has started introducing with money following the person to really look at home and community-based care more formidably. But I think there is a role for everyone in this arena, because the need is going to be so great. All of us are going to need to do our part to make sure that this happens, whether it's adult daycare, whether it is home care, individualized care at home, whether we look at, I think now there's an allowance for a spouse or a child who is a caregiver, a dollar allowance to be reimbursed for the care that they give, because there's still an inordinate amount of care that is being administered by children for their parents. So what does that look like as a collective, with all of us doing our part to give the best type of service to those most in need who helped to raise us when we were, you know, to get us to where we are today?
And that's one component of our changing population. New Hampshire's becoming more diverse, both from in-migration from other states, but immigration as well.
Yep.
As you know, it's particularly in Manchester. It's one of the most diverse cities in our state. You have services to work with new Americans and immigrants that are coming in. Can you talk about the services that you provide, what's needed out there, and how do you operate in that space that has become so politically charged as well?
Tough question, yes. So all the work that Catholic Charities New Hampshire does with our immigration legal services is above board. It is all legal work. We don't do any work at the border. We do agree that we have a fundamentally broken immigration system, and we do need to get to some kind of bipartisan effort to really address this issue and fix this issue. It is a lightning rod for everyone. And the minute I mention anything that we do in the immigration realm, it right away there is judgment, there is accusation, and how dare you? And I know you're hiding them somewhere. Look under the table; they're there somewhere. But you know, we help people from the point of adjustment or green card status to naturalization or citizenship status. They have been a critical and essential part of our workforce in our nursing facilities, in our other social service programs. They, you know, are looking for a better life from where they originated from, and equal opportunity. Our nation is based on immigrants. You know, when the Irish came in at the turn of the century, even before that, they were denigrated and vilified, as were the Italians, as any other group that preceded them. And now it's just whoever's turn is at the border right now, whoever's coming in, that is their turn in a sense. And it's a shame that this is how we have to treat the other, because at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue. And, you know, we, by the grace of God, we didn't have a choice as to where we were born. You know, and some of these people are fleeing gang violence. Their daughters are getting raped. Their sons are being recruited in the gangs. As a parent, what would you want for your child? You didn't get a choice to be born where you were, but I do think we have a human responsibility to at least push for an answer and push for a solution and look at the humanness of it and how we want to operate or exist as a human race, not, you know, as an us and them, but how can we coexist and come up with some solutions once and for all.
You also provide a lot of services around families, as an adoptive family. I'm very
thank you.
Close to, you know, the fact that you have adoption services, that you help women who are at risk and pregnant. Can you talk about the different services you offer for children and families?
Sure. So I think of, we have a counselor in Nashua who does only counseling for children, and she has a 3 or 4 month wait list because she's very busy and she's bilingual. So that is a robust business now with everything going on with everything children are dealing with, the anxiety and social media frenzy and depression and things like that. So that's really important. Our Place is a program in Manchester and Nashua that addresses, it used to be just for teen moms, and now it's sort of evolved into younger moms and working with some new Americans who are coming in and dealing with pregnancy for the first time. And we will engage that life plan with them. We'll do some financial literacy training and exploring all the other social determinants of health. And we do have a nurse work with them through their pregnancy, and then a counselor or a case manager will work with them through age 3 to teach them parenting skills, help them really with the goal of preventing neglect or abuse, and really for them to be the best parent they could be. I wish I had a program like that when my kids were younger, because it was it would have been helpful, you know.
So with the scope of services that Catholic Charities offers people, obviously there is the faith-based aspect to it, a Catholic faith, I would assume, since it's New Hampshire Catholic Charities. Can you talk a little bit about how the Catholic faith kind of helps shape the mission of New Hampshire Catholic Charities, and also how it helps inform kind of any sort of new programs that you look to bring to the community?
So it certainly informs us of our mission and what sort of compels us to do the work that we do. It's not out of obligation or compulsion. It really is driven by love. And you can see that with each worker that we hire. And that is a big deal, because we really hire for mission to get the right people on the bus. And the way they carry themselves and the way they administer themselves, they really strive to meet the person where they are. And oftentimes when someone comes into our district offices or our programs, it might sound trite, but it's the first time someone has looked at them, you know, or looked up at them or smiled at them or greeted them in potentially a week. Or it might be the first time that they've heard, yes, we will help you. And I can't underestimate that. When sometimes you see someone who might be vulnerable or who might not present so well, if they're homeless or if they're disheveled or if they don't have the means, where they get dismissed or they're invisible or they're treated you know, less than human in a sense. So just honoring them for where they are and meeting them where they are, it has to start with that, right? And we're not out to proselytize. We're not trying to convert anyone, but our mantra is more, you know, preach the gospel at all times and when necessary, use words. So how are we living out that gospel by the work that we do? That's what's really the metric or the measure. And how can we at all times work to get toward yes? It doesn't mean we're going to give you everything you ask for. Can you buy us a car? Can you buy us a home? I'd like a vacation home or this or that. But we will work to push you appropriately so that there's some buy-in, that there's some ownership, so that we're also trying to break that cycle of codependency. So we will teach you and we will walk with you. We will teach you how to fish. And we will carry you when needed, but at the end of the day, we want you to honor yourself more than anyone by allowing yourself to learn the skills so that you can help yourself at the end of the day. and then have the dignity of a job and have the dignity of independence and have the dignity of your own home and your own vehicle and make your own decisions. You know, that's involving the Catholic social teaching principles of subsidiarity and solidarity and, you know, just meeting people where they are to really bring them along.
You had mentioned the St. Charles home earlier in Rochester. I lived there in Rochester. I'm very familiar with it. And I want to talk about, you know, when you have to, as a nonprofit, decide to pivot services. And I used to serve on a board for an organization called Our House for Girls in Dover, which was a residential home for girls who had to be removed from their homes due to abuse and neglect. It was a temporary safe place to be until a long-term solution could be found. Unfortunately, the organization eventually had to disband because the financial pressures ended up being too much. You know, the reimbursement from the state wasn't coming in at the rate it was. Donations were hard to sometimes get. The state was changing how it was placing children. And our fixed costs, you know, never went away, you know, whether you had a full census or not. Made it very challenging. Can you talk about St. Charles Home, which has been around a long time, was an institution in Rochester, and how you pivoted the services there?
So my guess is we were probably at the same table that our place was, or your Dover Girls Home was at the table when we were, I think it was around 2009 or 2012, right after that financial downturn there in the economy. Same conversation where moving forward, in a year's time, this was the conversation back then. Most of you won't be at the table here because funding is changing, you know, placement is changing, and all these other things. So, I remember meeting with the administration at the time. It was run by some of the leadership were sisters there, and talking to them about, you know, what. So this is a gift for us. We have a year to plan what the next evolution is going to be.
Because so it had served as a
group home.
Yes.
Yep. For at that time, well over 50 years, and had some great outcomes. I mean, just similar to the charism of the program you just described. But it gave us a year to really plan, which is, you don't usually get that time. Usually it's sometimes you lose a grant and it's just like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do now? We have to change on, you know, pivot on a dime. So they tried to do initially some weekend parenting retreats to help those just to navigate the challenges of parenting when they had so many other challenges in their life, job challenges or maybe mental health challenges or whatever the other issue was. It just ended up being so time intensive and a money loser just based on the population we were serving. So we started talking about the idea of a school, and we had petitioned the state to open up as a school. I think we spent 3 years fighting it because there was a Blaine Amendment on the books that said you can't provide state funding to like Catholic facilities, something like that, from the 1800s, 1850s or something like that. Yet we were providing a program as it was at St. Charles that was receiving state funding with sisters running it, but it wasn't perpetuating or pushing Catholic, you know, it wasn't a Catholic program in a sense. So they already had set the precedent, but they were saying we couldn't open a school. So we ended up opening the school. It is a K-8 program. It is for those who are not thriving in a, on an IEP plan. At the schools and have extreme behavioral issues. So we provide intensive therapeutic behavioral intervention services and teachers and paraprofessionals. It functions as a typical school, but it just has that behavioral intervention program. Before this school was set up, some of these kids were being bused 3 hours each way every day to get to these specialized programs out of state. Can you imagine that? Just 6 hours on a bus, and then you're going to school for the day. I'd be out of my mind.
Right.
You know, I can't imagine these young kids, you know, having to deal with this. But really phenomenal program. The goal is to teach them also social norms so they can coexist in a typical social setting, whether it's in the community, or our goal is to really get them or integrate them back into a public school setting. And we've had some of them do that, which has been wonderful to see.
So I know we're running out of time, but wanted to touch on so many programs, and as we talked about earlier, they need fuel, you know, they need support. In our December issue, we cover nonprofits and we talked about that it's a challenging fundraising atmosphere that nonprofits find themselves with. A lot of federal pandemic funding is drying up. The outpouring of funds that came out during the pandemic may be subsiding a bit. Can you talk about what your own experience is? What does it take to make sure an organization of this size can run and function and provide all these services?
So there's a lot of touch points. At the end of the day, it's all about relationships. You know, we navigate relationships, we build relationships, we sustain relationships, you know, and even with donors. So how are you engaging your donor? You talked about what the magazine can do to give back, and you talked about advertising or helping with messaging. Even your business is about engaging. It's about relationships. So it's the same thing. How do we engage with our donors? Tell our story. Hopefully they feel that there's, you know, it is the story pulling at the heartstrings for some of them. Is it pulling at the headstrings? Some people are numbers people. Other people want to know, what did you do to transform Mary's life? What did you do to transform Matt's life? Things like that. So I have a portfolio. I meet with donors. I mean, it's telling our story, really looking at impact. Are we moving lives forward? Are we continuing to innovate? Are we continuing to drive change? If we're not doing that, then we don't deserve to be in business. So everyone takes that very seriously. Our next project that we're working on is affordable housing for the working class and affordable housing for seniors, hoping to have shovel in the ground in Peterborough by August or September with a 96 unit project. And then we're going to be looking at building that across the state. So that will require additional donors. And some communities are pushing back with the NIMBY issue. You know, not in my backyard. And other communities like Peterborough have wholly embraced it. And donors are stepping up to say, I want to support this because we have a 0% vacancy rate in our town. And we can't hire workers at the ball bearing plant or, you know, at our grocery stores or at the hospital because we don't have affordable housing. So it really is a community effort. And how can we partner, you know, with our communities to get the messaging out? How can we partner with, you know, other people who can see the value in our work, that we're really trying to, you know, build a community. And when we build up our communities, everyone wins.
I think that's a great way to end it right there. We build up our communities, everyone wins. I love that. Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us again. Tom Blonsky is the president and chief executive officer of Catholic Charities New Hampshire. We appreciate you speaking to us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed the stories and information you heard on today's podcast, find more by subscribing to Business NH Magazine or visiting businessnhmagazine.com. I'm Matt Mowry.
And I'm Christine Kerrigan. BizCast NH is a production of Granite Media Group.